From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In Washington, the foreign policy hawks are soaring, riding the uplift of a superheated war on terror. The Bush administration is already aiming America's military might at Baghdad. But the newly powerful hawks in and around the White House don't want to stop there. They see regime change in Iraq as the first step in a larger dream: wholesale democratization of the Arab world. This hour, On Point, to Baghdad and beyond, pulling back the curtain on the full agenda of Washington's high-flying hawks. We begin tonight with one of Washington's most vocal advocates for radical change in the Arab world. Just days after September 11th, James Woolsey, former director of the Central Intelligence Agency, called for regime change in Iraq. Now he sees a golden opportunity to reshape the entire Middle East. Earlier, I spoke with James Woolsey and asked him what the upshot would be to war in Iraq.
I think there's at least a chance that if we do this right and help bring decent government headed toward democracy, perhaps certainly not a full-blown democracy at first, to the capital of the Caliphate, Baghdad, one of the most prestigious and important historical places in the Muslim world, we will begin something that we probably should have begun a long time ago, which is helping bring the Mideast beyond Israel and Turkey into a world of decent government rather than what it is now, a collection of pathological predators and vulnerable autocracies.
And when you say decent government, you mean democratic government. But the Middle East has not been known as a hospitable region to democracy.
Well, that's true. And it may not be full democracy immediately, but there are places such as Qatar and Bahrain and Jordan to some extent that are, I think, headed in a positive direction with majlises and rights for women and the like. And after all, this is not a Muslim problem. Half of the Muslim-predominant states in the world are non-Arab, about 23 such states. And Freedom House says about half of those are democracies, and that includes some of the poorest countries in the world, Mali and Bangladesh, for example. And there are a lot of places in the world, Latin America, Asia with Taiwan, Russia, Germany, and Japan as of 1945, where all sorts of very wise people said, you know, those places are never going to be able to become democracies. But one by one, the world has gone from 1914, when it had about 8 or 10 democracies, to today where it has about 120. Now, many of those are only partially free, like Russia, rather than wholly free in Freedom House's terms, like, say, the Netherlands. But a lot of progress has been made over the course of the last 88 years. And I think for far too long we've regarded the Middle East as our gasoline station instead of treating its people as people whom we ought to be of help to them in bringing about decent government. And I think that needs to change.
You've said that we now face a golden opportunity to do just that in the Middle East, to help bring better government, to help bring democracy on the other side of a war with Iraq. What makes this a golden opportunity?
Bernard Lewis, who I think is the country's leading authority on the Middle East at Princeton, Bernard says that Iraq is probably the Arab country that's best suited to democracy because for 40 years they'd had a terrible dictatorship and know what they want to get away from. They know that it's a well-educated population. They have the second largest oil reserves in the world, so one isn't going to have to ship in a lot of money. They can certainly support themselves. And it will take work, it will take effort, but nearly one in five Iraqis lives outside Iraq, many in the United States and Europe and Britain, and would like to go back and have gotten a taste for what a decent government can be like. This is not going to be easy. We shouldn't assume that this is going to be something we'll do overnight, but I don't believe it's hopeless at all, any more than Germany or Japan or Russia or Taiwan or South Korea or Chile were hopeless.
Then, James Woolsey, let's look for a moment just to the other side of Iraq, assuming that with some great effort it can be done there. What is, in your view, the wider opportunity in the Middle East?
Well, I believe that the mullahs in Iran are sitting there looking at the horizon and thinking of themselves like the inhabitants of the Kremlin in 1988 or Versailles in 1788. The storm isn't quite overhead yet, but is clearly coming. They've lost the students, they've lost the women, they've lost the reformers, and they're increasingly losing some of the ayatollahs. So I believe that if we are effective in bringing about a decent government in Iraq, I don't think Iran is going to stay the way it is much longer. I don't think we should or would have to, or it would be wise at all for us to use military force against Iran. We don't want to drive all these wonderful reformers and women and students into the arms of the crazy mullahs who run the country. But I believe that we to at least have a possibility of seeing some fundamental change in Iraq and Iran over the course of the next months to years.
What about Saudi Arabia and Egypt, if we're talking region-wide, James Woolsey, about democratization?
Well, we can't do all of these things at once. I mean, after all, we were allied for nearly 4 years in World War II with history's greatest murderer, Joseph Stalin, because we had a more immediate problem, Adolf Hitler. And it took us over 40 years to get Stalin's dictatorship. Eventually, we got it done. And eventually, I think that the autocracy that is Saudi Arabia is not meant to last. But we certainly don't want to take on all these fights at once. We need to have a temporary cordial relations of convenience with Saudi Arabia, somewhat the way we had them with Stalin's Russia, Soviet Union, and World War II.
In an article that James Fallows is bringing out in the Atlantic Monthly, he quotes you, James Woolsey, saying, it's not Americanizing the world, it's Athenizing it, and it's doable.
Yeah.
Fallows quotes a British official in response to the notion of democratizing the Middle East, saying, these are the ruminations of insane people. Is there something fundamentally different emerging in the American and European view of this region?
Well, there has been a lot of world weariness on the part of the Europeans and some British over the years. But if you look back to World War I, when there were 8 or 10 democracies in the world, it was a world of kingdoms, empires, colonies, and autocracies of various sorts. And today, according to Freedom House, there are about 120 democracies in the world. That's an order of magnitude increase in the lifetime of a single person. So if you only look forward and talk about democratizing the Middle East, everybody says, my goodness, well boy, that's really an ambitious undertaking. If you look back and see what we have done, most all of Latin America, half of sub-Saharan Africa, much of Asia, virtually all of Europe, all of these places are democracies that were not 88 years ago.
Well,
so I think your British observer is not forward-looking enough.
What about the role of the military in this onward picture that you describe? In Iraq, the military is front and center as the American tool of addressing regime change. You've written that B-52s are not just a pretty good tool for women's liberation in Afghanistan, suggesting that the military can be useful and instructive on a wider stage. How do you see the U.S. military being part of this democratic movement, if it should happen, post-Iraq?
It could go a number of different ways, and it may be that this will take some years, and there'll be substantial difficulty. But I think we need to work together with the Turks and with the British, especially, in helping see that the country is held together and that it has some sort of a federal structure, so there is some degree of local autonomy, and that reasonable institutions, either democratic or leading relatively soon toward democracy, are put in place. And certainly U.S. forces are going to be important early on, but keep in mind, Saddam's regular army didn't fight in 1991.
But what about the role of the American military beyond Iraq, in the region, in terms of democratization?
Well, I believe that we will have to be in Iraq, and hopefully not in many other places, but at least in Iraq. I believe our armed forces will have to be the instrumentality that brings down the dictatorship, then stays around enough to be able to help enforce some type of a peaceful transition. Now, I think we have made a mistake in Afghanistan at not being involved more out in the country. We are going to have to do more than that in Iraq, but we ought to be trying to work ourselves out of a job as soon as possible by helping the Iraqi military rebuild as subordinate to a constitutional structure in Iraq, and hopefully also by some degree of reliance on friendly forces from neighboring states such as Turkey.
You describe kind of a democratic revolution around the region, then with an assist from the U.S., sometimes even led by the United States or U.S. military. Others have described this as American imperialism. How do you answer that characterization?
It's certainly not imperialism. We're not trying to take anybody's land. The only land I think we've ever asked for in any of the three world wars of the 20th century, two hot and one cold, is enough to bury our dead in Normandy. We aren't trying to impose our system on anybody. What we are doing is, I think, following the British, and long before that, in a sense, the Romans, in carrying forth an ideal of government being responsive to the people that really originally was Athenian. But this idea has in the last 88 years gone a long way toward taking over the central thesis of how government should proceed in the world. We're not going to impose any tributes on any of these countries. We're not going to ask for any land. All we really want is for them to be able to live in peace and freedom, and we've done a fair amount in the last 88 years to bring the world in that direction, but there's still more to do, and much of it is in the Mideast.
How fully do you think Washington is coming around to acceptance of this as an opportunity?
I've been really encouraged at the president's State of the Union. I'm one of the people who liked him talking about the axis of evil. I think his statement early in the summer about Iran, in which he put himself essentially on the side of the students in the streets rather than the mullahs. I think his statement about the Palestinians, yes, getting a state of their own, but once they get rid of the corrupt dictatorship that rules them now and moves toward democracy, I think all of these head generally in the same direction. And I think some of the things Condoleezza Rice has said in recent weeks, as well as Secretary of Defense especially, are pointed that way. I wouldn't say it's a single movement, but it certainly looks to me as if all of the trends are headed roughly in that direction.
James Woolsey, thanks so much for joining us.
Good to be with you.
James Woolsey was director of the CIA from 1993 to 1995. He spoke with us from McLean, Virginia. We're talking tonight about the ascendant foreign policy hawks in Washington, their big dreams, and their full agenda in the Middle East. Should America use its power to spread democracy in the Middle East, beyond Baghdad? Will it work? Is this a beautiful dream or self-delusion? Are you on board with the big hawk agenda? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now is Nicholas Lemon, Washington correspondent for The New Yorker magazine. He's written extensively on the rise of foreign policy hawks in the Bush administration, including The War on What, a recent article in The New Yorker. Good evening and welcome, Nick Lemon.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for being with us. I think you just heard James Woolsey there, and this kind of sunshine warrior, as we heard Bill Keller call Paul Wolfowitz this weekend, this sunny view of pushing American power deeply, radically into the Middle East. How high-riding is this view of the world in Washington today, Nick Lemon?
Well, as you just heard, it's very high-riding. I mean, it's this whole thing, it's a fascinating story. It's like a one of the great sweeping Russian novels.
Yeah.
And it really has been going on for a long, long time. There was a fight that started breaking out within the Republican Party about 30 years ago.
All the way back in the Nixon administration.
Yeah, and particularly over the ABM treaty, anti-ballistic missile treaty. Things have just come full circle because we've gotten out of the anti-ballistic missile treaty. There's these profoundly different views of the world, and many of the key players have been in this fight continuously for 30 years.
But Nick Lemon, you've written very revealingly about this, and I want to talk more about that after the break that's coming up. But I have the sense that the American public at large is not up to speed with the agenda that seems to be roaring ahead in Washington.
Let me just say one quick thing before we go to break. I think Mr. Woolsey was giving you a very clear impression of the vision of the hawks, and if you got the feeling that these folks are sincere and they have this kind of very, very big idea that they think is going to improve the world, you're right. However, the rationale for invading Iraq has been, until very recently, much more specific to Iraq. It was about, protecting America from specific military threats from Iraq. And I think that was a little misleading. And now you're getting essentially what the real reason has been all along, which is that this is the opening of an attempt to produce a great systemic change throughout a whole region.
We want to take the chance tonight to pull back the curtains on that bigger agenda, because it's discussed in highbrow journals, but not so much on primetime television. And as you say, it's very real.
Let me go back. Do we have a minute more?
We just have 10 seconds before I've got to begin to take us out here.
Never mind. I'll save it until we come back.
Save it. We'll come back for it. We're talking tonight with New Yorker, Washington correspondent Nick Lemon about the hawks, big picture in Iraq and beyond in the Middle East, the foreign policy hawks who are in the ascendancy in Washington today. They see American power being applied broadly, widely, deeply. Would you have predicted a U.S. invasion of Iraq 1 year ago? Would you predict a wholesale effort to reshape the Mideast today? And how do you perceive the broader hawk agenda in the Middle East? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
From Boston University, this is
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the foreign policy hawks' big picture in Washington, the big view of Iraq and beyond in the Middle East. We're pulling back the curtain on the full hawk agenda, and it is in the ascendancy. And let us ask you, listeners, do the hawks have it right? Is this the golden moment to use U.S. power to redraw the politics, even the boundaries of the Middle East? And do you understand what's driving U.S. foreign policy today? Are you on board with the hawks' big agenda? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Our guest tonight is Nicholas Lemon, Washington correspondent for The New Yorker magazine. And Nick Lemon, you've written wonderfully about this phenomenon, how it's unfolding. You've said that the hawks are those who believe that the United States should remain the world's sole great power for many decades, and that force, rather than international cooperation, is the best means to that end. You've also written how their view of the world is fundamentally unlike that of many Democrats in administrations past, that there's a fundamentally different view of human nature that's being expressed in the hawks. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, this shows up in many, many issues. It's sort of the difference between liberals and conservatives. Do you get people far away to behave the way you would like them to behave by being nice to them, or do you, or by showing force? In other words, in terms of what Mr. Woolsey said, I don't doubt his sincerity, but it's worth asking exactly what does he mean by democracy? And this is a case where, you know, we're invading a country and militarily taking it over to bring them democracy. So, you know, it's not clear that people who live in countries that have never been democracies are so sold on the idea of their being invaded by the U.S. military and sort of conquered and then reconstituted as a democracy. So, although it should be said, the hawks, you know, believe that there will be total cheering in the streets of Baghdad when the first planes fly over.
But if it's not all that clear what's going to happen, then why are the hawks riding so high in Washington? You say there's a lot of envy. Sure, step back for us.
Let me step back for a minute. I talked about 30 years ago. Let me talk about 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. This is where the history of all this begins, I think. Vice President Cheney was then Secretary of Defense. The Gulf War ended, the Soviet Union collapsed, and he had a group of people in his office produce a series of papers where they were supposed to think about what is the world, what should the world look like after the Cold War.
Mm-hmm.
And the key ideas, all the people who worked on this project, led by Cheney himself, are high up in the current Bush administration. And the key idea in this paper was that the United States should be the sole superpower, you know, as far forward as the eye can see, and should prevent the rise of other rival powers, so that the ideas that had driven foreign policy for centuries, really, of balance of power and containment and deterrence, were really no longer relevant, and you could have a kind of American hegemony throughout the world.
And Paul Wolfowitz, who's now so central to the new hawk push in Washington, was at the heart of the writing of this document.
Yeah, exactly. He was. And in this document, they talk about one of the key phrases is, let's expand the zone of democracy. But, you know, back to the these folks really believe this stuff. They're serious, smart, strategic thinkers. And when this administration came back into office, you know, the idea was, now is our chance to put into effect the ideas that we formed as we were leaving power at the end of the last Bush administration.
And they are doing it.
And they're doing it. I honestly, I mean, we never know, but I think this was very, very clear in the mind of the vice president and the people around him, and maybe less so in the mind of the president. But nonetheless, the question here is, what do you mean by democracy and expanding the zone of democracy? I mean, Mr. Woolsey first said we don't have in mind imperialism, and then I think I heard him comparing the hoped for American role in the world to that of Britain and Rome in the past.
Fairly well known for their empires.
Yeah, I mean, we call them empires. So there's more to this project than just giving everybody in the world the right of self-determination. It has a little more element of, you know, we know what system is right for you, so even if you don't have access to it now, or even if you wouldn't move to it on your own, we're going to kind of press it upon you, and you'll thank us later.
You write that
it's
Washington...
It's a little bit like, you know, in the British Empire, people use the word Christendom, which, you know, meant more than just everyone had to convert right away to Christianity, but it was sort of... We'll send missionaries and we'll try to convert people to Christianity over time, but Christendom connoted, you know, a world that sort of makes sense and is run along the rules that, you know, seem to be good if you're sitting in London.
And bend to our worldview.
Yeah, and I think their use of democracy would be quite analogous to the Victorian use of Christendom. It would be, you know, these countries won't be democracies in the way that America is a democracy today, and may not be for decades. But they're kind of on our side, and they've thrown in with us.
Nick Levin, our time is so short tonight. I want to get into some of what this might mean materially. And I know this is a kind of a will-o'-the-wisp thing that comes and goes. Some days hawks will step up and say it outright. Others, they won't. But we read and hear about ideas that victory in Iraq, presuming victory in Iraq, and presuming some kind of democracy, very broad stroke in Iraq, would give the U.S. leverage against Syria and Iran, would put the U.S. in a better position to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, that would reduce U.S. reliance on Saudi oil, that would essentially give the U.S. something like a free hand or a big stick or a big crowbar to make change all over. We even hear at its furthest kind of fringes the possibility of redrawing boundaries. Is all that in play?
I think so. I mean, much remains to be seen. In other words, what we have done so far, this gets back to what I was saying before, is we've gotten regime change in one country, and that is Afghanistan. I think within 6 months we will have gotten regime change in a second country, and that's Iraq. We're actively working for regime change in the Palestinian Authority, which isn't a freestanding country yet, but we're working for it. And then in Pakistan, a fourth country, although we didn't change the regime, you know, we've sort of become very actively involved in trying to change the way the country is structured. Now, in none of those cases, now in Iraq we're pre-invasion, in none of those cases have we produced something yet that is recognizable as a democracy, at least to me.
And all of this is very different from the kind of careful button-down diplomacy and multilateral problem-solving that we had become accustomed to as the general kind of establishment U.S. view of how foreign policy is done. Nick Levin, if you would stand by, I want to welcome to our conversation Fawad Ajami. He's director of the Middle East Studies Program in the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University. Good evening, and welcome, Fawad Ajami.
Good evening. Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us. I think you heard Jim Woolsey earlier. You've heard Nick Levin describing what's going on here. But let's go to the practicality of what's being imagined and conceived. Is it possible that the United States could, through a combination of raw power and influence, take on the democratization of the Middle East and succeed?
Tom, I think we have to understand that this campaign is not a Wilsonian campaign to bring democracy to the lands of the Arab world. This may be the byproduct at the end, but we begin with this regime in Baghdad that's a menace to American interests, that's a menace to the world, that's a menace to its own people. And it's important to overthrow this regime, and that's what this logic is all about.
Tonight, we're not debating that tonight, Fawad Ajami, and excuse me, but we really are trying, because we've talked so much about that, we're trying to pull the curtains back further to say, all right, what else is on the plate? What else is on the agenda? And what do you see as viable, practical goals beyond that? Can we indeed touch all these other Middle Eastern countries positively?
Well, I want to take issue with some of what you said, because it seemed to me not quite. I want to draw some fences around it, because the idea, for example, that some of these men in power are hawks without any regard for borders, that they're hell bent on changing the region, is not quite persuasive. For example, the chief hawk is written about usually is Paul Wolfowitz. I happen to have the advantage of being a friend of Paul Wolfowitz. I happen to have the advantage of having been his colleague. He was my dean, my boss for 7 years at Johns Hopkins. That's what he did between the end of Bush 1 and the return.
As we well know, yes.
Exactly. So none of what's said about him bears any resemblance to the very prudent man that he is. So the idea that these people are going to go to war in the Persian Gulf and that they are going to redraw the borders of the world, some of them are the very same men who drew back from going to Baghdad in 1991.
So I think they're much more careful. And we don't want to put this all on Paul Wolfowitz, but yet there is this kind of jack-in-the-box quality where, Monday, Tuesday, and Thursday, you're hearing one thing over here, and Wednesday, Friday, Saturday, you're hearing another. And some of what comes out, and it's not only Paul Wolfowitz who's in this faction, does have a very high ambition, high reach quotient to it.
Well, the world doesn't always give us what we want, and when we use American power, when we go to the region, we will confront the realities of that region. We'll try to transform them if we can. What we are really driven by these days is that for a long, long time in the Middle East, in the Muslim world, in the Arab world, we lived with a balance of power. We accepted the logic of things as it is. We accepted that there is this regime in Egypt that's our ally, the regime of Hosni Mubarak preceded by the regime of Anwar Sadat. We accepted the order of states in the Persian Gulf, and indeed, many of the players in the Bush administration, Bush 1, were quite close to the dynasties, and they called them the friendly royals at the time. And that then came September 11, and we discovered that the radicalism of the Arab world, the deep embedded radicalism of the Arab world, is what sent us the boys of September 11 and the terrors of September 11. So there is a temptation to go at the root of things, to try in some way to change the logic of things in the Arab world and to reform it if we can.
And that's really exactly the ambition that I'm trying to get at here tonight. And what does that mean in material terms beyond Iraq?
Well, I think that there is a kind of the argument, and I do subscribe to part of what Jim Woolsey said, again with some differences. The argument is that if you go to Iraq and you win in Iraq and you have a demonstration effect to the rest of the Arab world, you show the Arab world a secular regime, a relatively open regime. It's not going to be a Jeffersonian regime on the Tigris and the Euphrates. But what you try to do there is you come to this country which has been racked by 40 years or so of despotism and sectarian hatred between Sunni and Shia and Kurds and Turkmen. And you take this Tikriti gang of Saddam Hussein, which we spared in 1991, and we left in place. You take this Tikriti gang and you create a more open system in a country that's secular, in a country which has the second largest reserves of oil in the region.
But let's say that works.
How does it, conclusions.
But how does it work beyond that? Does it work just by attraction? Iraq just sits there as such a lovely model that the rest of the Middle East turns over a whole new leaf? Or does it mean the muscular imprint of America on other countries in the Middle East beyond Iraq?
Well, I think the demonstration effect of democracy should never be underestimated. I mean, it's really a matter of copying, of borrowing. For example, when democracies ran ascendant in the world, other people wanted to have democratic forms. In the 20s and the 30s, when Nazism and fascism seemed to be the mode of the day, people in many, many countries, particularly in the Third World, particularly in the Arab world, wanted to have fascist, Nazi-like regime because they thought that these people make the trains run on time. So what you need is you need to show a place. This is a place in the Arab world with a combination of both some American power, some American prop, and its own and the will of its own people, their desire for reform, for an end of this nightmare, will show other Arabs a better alternative and that they will draw their own conclusions.
Fawad Ajami, stand by. I want to put this question to Nicholas Lemon. There's a way in which this sounds utterly attractive and logical, but you've written, Nicholas Lemon, that to many old-fashioned foreign policy realists, many of whom were senior advisors to the first President Bush, that there's also a big penumbra here of a lot that's sentimental and naive and, in your words, dangerously incautious. How so?
Well, let's see. There's a real disagreement here. There's shading. You're hearing clear shadings in what Mr. Woolsey said and what Professor Ajami is now saying. There's a difference in nuance, and Professor Ajami is speaking much more cautiously and is, as you can tell, resisting the idea of a sweeping remake of the region, which is exactly what Mr. Woolsey was saying.
And you quote others saying that there's a wide imperial rampage through the Middle East.
Let's slow down a little bit. The people in the first Bush administration were essentially making a bargain in the Middle East in which they said, look, I mean, they wouldn't have said this publicly, but I think, and I think Mr. Ajami would agree with this, their idea was this is a region that has never had a democracy in all its history. That's kind of a lost cause. And what we're really going for is keeping the oil supply stable and keeping the region kind of as secure and quiet as we can. What we want is peace, not internal reform. And I think there's a good argument. Mr. Ajami wrote a piece saying this in Foreign Affairs right after September 11th, that bargain that they were making didn't work because the regimes, particularly the Saudi regime, got worse and worse and worse and essentially gave birth to a generation of terrorists that they couldn't control who have now attacked us. On the other side of it, all military operations carry a high degree of risk. In other words, in lots of times before, and particularly during the Cold War, the United States has said we're going to try to spread democracy throughout the world and has tried to do it in many countries. But the means were they ran up to coups and sort of supplying rebels and things like that. But with the exception of Vietnam, which was a very good exception, the American intervention tended to stop at sending U.S. forces to seek regime change in countries. When you start military operations, you kind of put things in play, and you can't be completely sure what's going to happen afterwards.
But what seems to distinguish this crowd is that very uncertainty seems to be exciting. It seems to be the smell of opportunity.
Well, I think that's a little unfair. I mean, I think the uncertainty of military operations...
We've read Paul Wolfowitz say, we can't say exactly what comes after, but we got the general gist here. Let's jump in. It will work out.
I think they think, and this is just from me as a reporter speaking to lots and lots of hawks, and this is sort of hovering underneath the surface, that things have happened in the pure, military capability and hardware side that have changed the nature of war so profoundly that Vietnam-type situations are not going to happen. We're fairly protected from them. And that's increased the degree of confidence. But and also there's just a question I quoted in this article a lot of realists out of government, professors, not Brent Scowcroft,
et cetera. That's right.
And these are people who are just much more focused on anything you do to change the internal dynamic of a country. There's a lot more that can go wrong than that can go right.
Nick Lehman, Fawad Ajami, we've got to take a short break. Please stand by. We're talking tonight about the Hawks' big foreign policy picture. Should America use a conquered Iraq or a liberated Iraq as a base, as a crowbar, to push democracy into the entire Middle East? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
From Boston University,
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the foreign policy hawks in Washington and their big picture, their big view of the world, the big view of Iraq and beyond in the Middle East. Listeners, do the hawks have it right? Is this the golden moment to use U.S. power to redraw the politics of the Middle East, of the entire region, potentially? Our guests tonight are Nicholas Lemon, Washington correspondent for The New Yorker magazine, and Fawad Ajami, director of Mideast Studies in the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University as well. You're also welcome to join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Sandra's on the line. Hi, Sandra. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
Well, I think that this, the idea that we're going to go into Iraq and get rid of an oppressive dictator and that suddenly Iraq is going to turn around and become a democracy is a terrible, dangerous fantasy. I can see that it's an attractive fantasy. It's not unlike the crusades or imperialism to have, this kind of driving desire to save and everybody would certainly like life to be better for Iraqis, but it takes generations for people to grow out of oppression. I work with East German teenagers who were born after the wall came down, and they are afraid to talk, to engage in a controversial conversation, and they were born after the wall came down.
But Sandra, is there something between where Iraq is now and perfect democracy that would be an improvement and maybe even a light unto the region?
It has to come from the people, and it's going to come with economic opportunity for a broader group of people and education, and the intellectual and the driving powers in Iraqis' economy and intellect have mostly left, or they're on the streets selling their furniture, I mean, from what I understand. So it's going to take an economic recovery before we can even begin to build a democracy, and that's going to be years.
So it's not easy, and we thank you for the observation. Fawad Ajami, as you said before, no one's expecting a spanking perfect clean democracy right out of the box here. But what degree of improvement would be necessary to make this an attractive model or example to its neighbors?
Well, Tom, this region can break our hearts, and it can break the heart of the hawks when the time comes. I mean, this is my... The Arab world is my birthplace. Mm-hmm. Its language is my first mother language. And I know its ways, and I know its defeats, and I know it's the chameleons in it, and I know that it can give us many false signals. I think my standards are quite low, actually. I always say about Iraq, my standards are quite low. A regime that's better than Saddam Hussein, that's almost anybody in Iraq. So basically, if you take a look at Iraq, the idea is not so much that we would transform it radically overnight. Hmm. The idea is we'd give the Iraqis a chance to build a multi-sectarian society based on the consent of its people, with some self-determination in the north for the Kurds, perhaps in a federal system, an end to the nightmare that the Shia majority has endured in Iraq ever since the creation of Iraq as an independent state put together by the British in 1921. So it's really about that. These are very modest goals. And then you leave the Arab world to gaze upon Iraq and draw for itself conclusions about its own politics, about the malignancies that visit it, about the radicalism deep within these kinds of societies. For example, we've invested more than $50 billion in Egypt over the last 25 to 30 years or so. What did it get us? It got us Mohammed Atta, who flew into the North Tower, and it got us Ayman Zawahiri, who is the number two, the deputy of Osama bin Laden.
But let
so
me
we
ask
are the friends, we are the friends of the rulers, but we pay the price of this kind of friendship.
But Nicholas Lehman, how about it? Is this very relatively modest improvement that Fawad Ajami describes, is that the dream of the hawks, and is that seen as a sufficient kind of city on a hill, as a sufficient model to engender change elsewhere? Or is there more muscle, American muscle, that's anticipated going into active persuasion elsewhere?
Well, you know, first of all, there's hawks and hawks. I mean, I appreciate the modesty of what Professor Ajami is saying. You've heard a range, because Mr. Woolsey was much more sort of soaring in his optimism. A couple of observations about this. What's happened in the past, you know, it's not that new. For at least 100 years, the United States has been trying to encourage something. Maybe it's democracy, whatever it is, or in other countries around the world. We've tried various means. And what tends to go wrong often is our country is not committed enough, and maybe it shouldn't be, to spend enormous amounts of money to change faraway places. So what we do is sort of default to a cheaper option of saying, in places like the Middle East, let's find a friendly dictator who seems to be kind of modernizing the country and hope for the best. And that was the feeling about the Shah of Iran, and that was the feeling in the earlier days about Saddam Hussein himself.
But if that's the default setting, doesn't that make a mockery of the kind of transformative hawk agenda that seems to be exciting so much?
Let me say one other thing about the hawks is that the element besides democracy in here is military power. What's again, old story is the United States trying to influence the direction of faraway countries. A less common thing is the United States sending military forces to seek, as we say in Washington, regime change in countries. And I think the thinking within at least some circles of the administration is that it's not just the city on a hill stuff, it's also the show of power and force that is what will produce results that we'll like better in places like the Palestinian Authority, Syria, Iran, and eventually, you know, the glittering prizes, Saudi Arabia and Egypt.
So, but of course, the implication there is the potential readiness to use that force beyond Iraq. Otherwise, what's it matter?
I think so. I mean, I think it's not just a story about showing people a good, attractive model, although that's part of it. The idea of military force is also part of the equation. And I'd be interested to see if Professor Ajami agrees with that.
Fawad Ajami.
Well, I think, first of all, this gives me a chance to comment on Nick Lemon's craft. I mean, this is your interviewing the best reporter on these matters, so I'm a big fan of what he says. And I
As are we.
Everything he writes with tremendous attention. I think that there is this deep tension, if you will, within the American imperium, within Pax Americana. One, if you will, we would go into Iraq, we would do this job, we would end up with Shades of Desert Storm 1991. Mm-hmm. We would live with the status quo in the region because we know this is a very difficult region. One is this transformative project that we've been talking about. And I have a feeling that when the day is done, when we fight this, and for reasons that Nick was alluding to, which is in fact the economic limits, I mean, we have worries, do we pay for this war? Because in Desert Storm, it was more Operation Tin Cup. Other people paid for this war. Now we are going to pay for this war. So in terms of blood and treasure, as we face the cost of empire, I bet you anything, if you invite us in a year or two, we will be in the same debate that the Brits were after 1920-21, when they began to talk about the thankless deserts, when they understood the cost of empire and they relied on the Air Force, because they didn't want to be sucked into these conflicts of these distant lands.
Maybe, so but right now there's a different tune coming out of Washington, and it's coming out with surprising volume. I want to get a few more calls in here if we can. Jay is on the line. Welcome, Jay. You're on the air.
Good evening, Tom. Thank you for having me.
Sure.
Tom, I'd like to make a comment in the question. My comment is this. A little more than 10 years ago, when we went to war, we liberated Kuwait.
Yes.
This was the very same Huck were in power. Now, after we...
Well, yes and no. They were there, but they weren't alone there.
Sure, but most of these people, others, they were there, and they're part of the Huck. And Paul Wolfowitz, of course. Mm-hmm. And my question is this. After we... liberate the Kuwait, told Amir of Kuwait, now everything's okay, do you need anything else?
Right.
Of course, he has 40 wives. He said all he needs is a Viagra. I said, well, that's fine. But the question is this. If we would like to have a model democracy, wouldn't that be easier to have it in Kuwait, which was more than a million people and everything under the American control? And then, so why couldn't we start it there? As early as a few months ago, there was some polling done by the Gallup poll. Almost 80% of Kuwaitis are anti-American when it comes to this war.
It's interesting and a mischievous question, but let's put it to Fawad Ajami. If democracy is so great and we want to take it out, why haven't we started with our friends? Why a gift to our avowed enemy first?
You ask a very good question, Tom. I do have a comment that may interest our caller. Actually, Kuwait really has the elements of a democratic society. I know Kuwait reasonably well. I was just in Kuwait not so long ago, and one of my most moving experiences there were to attend a very lively session of the Kuwaiti parliament, where the government was taken to task for everything. No visitors of dawn hold people off to prison or kill them in Kuwait. It's a very, very forgiving society. So the idea that Kuwait somehow is this authoritarianism and that the Sabah family rules alone is completely a stereotype. The merchants have power, the intellectuals have power. But you, Tom, have asked a fundamental question. If democracy is so good, why don't we give it to our friends first rather than hold it as a weapon in the face of our enemies? It's a damn good question. And I think even in the case of Yasser Arafat, recently we said to him, look, you are an authoritarian leader. And a very honest question was asked. Would we be talking to democracy to Yasser Arafat had he put an end to the terror, to the suicide bombings, and to the violence? No, we wouldn't have. But we started talking democracy to him because suddenly there was blood in the streets. So we are ambivalent, and we are not always consistent on this message.
Clearly. Nick Lemon, I want to ask you, you've written, you said Washington's attitude toward the hawks seems to be official disapproval. This is, I guess, establishment Washington. But official disapproval tinged with sneaking admiration. They have an incaution that usually makes holding office impossible, and yet they've gained high-ranking jobs and kept them. Their operational persistence and their intellectual boldness give them disproportionate influence. The origins of just about all Bush's doctrinal statements over the last year clearly can be traced to the hawks. Having written that and heard that and seen their popularity and power in Washington, are you as confident as Fawad Ajami that in a couple of years the United States will have reverted to some kind of golden mean of foreign policy, some greater reluctance to be intervening in the Mideast?
I think what will happen is that things won't be, with the caveat that nobody except the late Gene Dixon could predict the future, I think what would be most likely is reverting to some version of the past that I was alluding to before, where after the Iraq operation, the president, whoever it is, starts talking to his pollster and sort of hearing that there isn't a lot of public appetite for a big American project to reform another region of the world unless there's an imminent threat involved. And then we would go back to the old game of trying to sort of pressure people to change, but not in as aggressive a way. And then the worry that you get into is accepting as half a loaf totalitarian dictators who seem to be, relatively secular, relatively modernizing, relatively on our side, and you tell yourself, well, their people will at least see the benefits of capitalism, will enjoy the benefits of stability, and over time will come democracy.
And is that enough? Fawad Ajami, there's one more issue I have to bring up.
An example, just to interrupt, not in the region at all, but a sort of classic example right now is Russia, where, the Bush...
Not all, perfect, but better than before.
And what I was going to say is all presidents, when they get in power, find it simpler to deal with a leader on the ground that they feel they can deal with than to try to get great systemic change in another country.
Fawad Ajami, 1 minute left. Israel and the right-wing policies in Israel seem to line up fairly well at the moment with the hawks' view of the Middle East. What's the significance of this lining up, or is it even linkage?
At the risk of violating my marching orders, I just can't help this, to show you the flexibility that's in Washington. We have an alliance with Pervez Musharraf. We don't mind that he's not a Democrat.
Mm-hmm.
We have an alliance with Turkey. We don't mind that the secular regime in Turkey, the Kemalist establishment, is more committed to secularism than it is to democracy. We turn a blind eye to this. So it's a very big world. It's a very, and even our war on terror, we have cooperations with the Egyptians, we have cooperation with the Algerians. We even, pray tell, we don't talk about it much, but we even have cooperation behind closed doors with the Syrians. None of these people are Democrats, but we need them on the war on terror. And for me, I think I accept what happened on September 11 and realize we have to live with these regimes as they are. I mean, that's our dilemma today.
Well, it's going to leave a couple of questions unanswered for us there. But I thank you both for joining us tonight. Fawad Ajami, Director of Middle East Studies at the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
And Nicholas Lemon, Washington correspondent for The New Yorker. Thanks so much for here this hour. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're fun.